The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Talk. So we often think of the source of our problems is something that's, you know, out there. We think we're angry because of someone else's actions, or we think that we can't be happy because we have chronic neck pain, or we think that we're definitely right and other people are wrong and they need to be different in order for the world to be okay. You know, all of these share the quality of kind of putting the problem out there. But in this awareness practice that we do, looking at the body and the mind, you know, we're turning the awareness to our own experience. And as we do that, we come to see that it's the mind that brings happiness or suffering in our life. And, you know, there's always a lot of inputs to our senses, sounds that we hear and ideas that we take in and things that we see going on. And I think even after only a little bit of practice, you can believe that you're not going to be able to control all of those completely. So if we look honestly, we can see that there isn't much hope in fixing the world. Yes, if that's what's going to take for us to be happy, there's not much hope. But the only real hope then is to train this mind that knows experience. There we have some hope. So maybe we're not even supposed to have hope, I don't know, but that's a phrase I'm using for, you know, that's where the possibility is. Sometimes in Western culture, we have a phrase that says something is only in the mind, you know, or only in the head, you know, oh, that's just in your head. And usually it means that that's not really real or that it doesn't really matter, or that we should be able to just dismiss it or snap out of it. You know, if that's just in your head, you should be able to do something different. But through this practice, I've come to see it differently. I think it's good news that things are in our mind, because our mind can be changed. So that's the good news, is that it's all in your head. That means there's some chance. So the key to happiness is right here, you know, right inside. And also, you know, the suffering is right here. We can't really blame things that are out there. So it's great that things are in my mind, but there is going to be some work in making the mind into a nice place to live. I think we also see that when we do the practice. So I want to read a couple of verses from the Dhammapada. These are the opening to stanzas. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. So just to be clear about the language, that was Gil Bronstahl's translation. It uses that word corrupted, and it doesn't mean that a person's mind is inherently that way. It just means that currently the mind has some unwholesome states in it. When we speak or act with a corrupted mind, it means we have unwholesomeness at that moment. And when we act from those, then there is some kind of painful result from that. Suffering for us or for others or for both. And this image of the wagon wheel following the hoof of the ox is, I think, supposed to be an image of burden and heaviness. You know, imagine this heavy cart being drawn along by an ox. So it's like that when the mind is caught up in unwholesomeness and acting from that. And then similarly, when the other side with the peaceful mind, that's when the mind is currently wholesome. And if we speak or act from that place, then there's some kind of happiness is going to follow from that. And the image of the never departing shadow, it's not a shadow like a bad thing. It's a shadow like something that's light, effortless. You don't have to create your shadow. It's just going to be there. And it just follows without any weight. It doesn't drag along like a cart behind you. It just follows effortlessly. So that's also the image that goes with this, you know, this wholesomeness when we're acting from that place. So there's a lot to this teaching. I know it's read quite often, but nonetheless, I want to unpack it a bit so that we can look more carefully at this idea that the mind is the forerunner of all things. That's a pretty strong statement. So first of all, we see conditionality. We see that a certain kind of mind state brings a certain result. And so, you know, just in a practical sense, when the mind has anger, for example, we tend to see only things that are irritating, things that are ugly, things that we don't like. If you walk into a room with an angry mind, you're probably going to see the torn carpet and the stain on the wall and so forth. And that's just kind of how it works with the mind. We can observe this in our own experience when there's irritation or anger in the mind. And then when the mind has greed in it, we tend to see what we want to possess. You know, we walk into the room and I don't know, they look at this Buddha statue and you say, wow, that's pretty nice. I wonder where I could get one of those. Something like that. So, you know, our mind sort of goes to what we would like to have. And then we also know that there are times when the mind is uneaseful or peaceful, or it's maybe even it has a metta or loving kindness or compassion. And then we tend to see also what is beautiful or wholesome. You know, we'll see the flowers on the table when we walk into a room, or we'll notice a person who is smiling, something that's in the pleasant or beautiful or wholesome realm. And then when the mind is dull or deluded, we don't notice much at all. What? What flowers? So there's, you know, there's nothing inherently right or wrong in what I'm describing. It's just how it works. And so you can observe this in your own experience. And wouldn't you say that's the case? Is it how the mind is actually influences what we're able to see in a room? Yeah. So then, you know, so that's one thing that we maybe comes out of the teaching in these verses. And then we can also notice the language of the first line of each of the stanzas. I'll read it again. It has three distinct phases. So it says, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. And those three verbs indicate kind of increasing involvement with experience. So all experience is preceded by mind. Okay, I think we could buy into that one. The mind has to be there and ready to receive experience in order to feel something. It sort of makes sense. Led by mind, that implies a stronger relationship. And then made by mind, oh, wait a minute. And we start to maybe have a question about the third one. So for example, if there's a bird singing outside, you know, did my mind make that? Well, no, it didn't literally make the sound, make the air vibrate. No, the bird did that. But the mind does play a bigger role than you might think. You know, we might think, oh, it's just I'm just hearing a bird outside. But in order to know that that's a bird, you have to invoke some memory of having heard a bird before. You recognize it based on that memory, and then you can identify, oh yeah, that's a bird. So that's the function of perception in the mind operating. That's how it works. It puts a concept or a label onto experience based on something, on knowing that experience before. The bird example is often given and I think pretty familiar. But it gets more fundamental than that. You know, we are carrying, as we walk around the world, we are carrying all kinds of background views and ideas that are shaping which experiences we have, which experiences get noticed. You know, at any given time, there are an enormous number of sensory inputs that we could be conscious of or be aware of. And, you know, there's probably some kind of sound in your environment, as well as the sound of my voice. You're seeing maybe what's on the screen, but you could be seeing other things like around the screen. You're feeling, you could be feeling where you're sitting. You could be feeling your clothing against the skin, but you might not at this moment. You know, there's all kinds of things, thoughts, moods. At any given moment, how much could you notice? Well, you can really only notice a small amount, actually. But, you know, which things are you noticing? So I gave some examples a few minutes ago about how the state of the mind shapes what it is that we'll see. If we go into a room, our emotion or mood or mind state has a big effect on what we experience. So it's pretty pervasive. I mean, it's actually more pervasive than just our kind of background mood. So the question maybe is, have you ever considered how it is that the mind has the current range of experience that it does? What shaped all of that? And you know, that's not something to like think about a lot and spend a lot of time figuring out. But I'll just offer a suggestion to be checked in practice, which is that the range that we can be aware of is determined largely by our habits of mind. And those were conditioned into us in a lot of complex ways. The patterns that they're basically the patterns that we've practiced again and again, but they've come in from our culture, our family, our society, our religious history, as well as our personal experiences that are unique to us and what we've practiced in meditation and through awareness practice. All of that has built up a bunch of habits and patterns and proclivities in the mind. But this is ongoing. So if we practice anger all day long, then we deepen the ruts of anger in the mind. You know, each moment of anger digs a little deeper in that rut. So it's more likely that the mind can fall in and run along that track. And when we're in the anger rut, it's like being in a trench that they used in warfare last century, this century too. So it's like a narrow, confined space with kind of an ugly view of mud and rocks. I don't know exactly what a trench is like, but that's my guess. So it's not a good place to live. And it limits, you know, what you can see quite a bit to be in that mind state. And sometimes that's how it happens. You know, we have anger in the mind. And so then we notice that that's what it's like. And of course, let me just add, when we are mindful of anger, it's not the same as digging deeper in the anger rut. It's only when we are angry and not mindful that we are continuing to dig it. If we're angry and mindful, then we're contributing also to mindfulness. Now, conversely, if we practice generosity, we strengthen that rut in quotes, that habit, let's say, that pattern. So the world of generosity is very different from the world of anger, isn't it? So the world of generosity is a lot more open or light. And I'm kind of creating an image here, but you know, maybe just we could imagine that generosity is a place that has a beautiful landscape with abundant fruit trees so that we always feel like we have something delicious to give to other people, something like that. So that's the world of generosity. And when the mind has that state present, then it can see in those ways. It sees that it has things to give. The mind state of anger, even if you might have all the same things to give, doesn't see. It doesn't see that it has anything to give. So you don't notice that. You don't think of that. You don't even think of giving something when you're angry, usually. Unless there's mindfulness and you have a chance. So the implication, quite quickly, we've gotten into deep territory here, haven't we? Whoa, what is the mind doing? So the implication of that is that we are not really innocent observers of experience. And I know that you know that from practice, but it never hurts to keep hearing it. We're not innocent observers. Our eyes are not cameras looking out on the world, just taking in exactly the neutral visual objects that are coming in. Our ears are not sound detectors that just, we open them up, we take in all the sounds that are there. It's not like that. There are filters. There are filters put in from the mind on our sense experience based on all of these habits and which ones are active at a given moment. So we have actually chosen at some precognitive level much of our experience. All experience is made by mind. Ouch. Now that doesn't mean that your intentional, logical mind has chosen this. You know, you sat down and thought about at 10 a.m. I'm going to experience, or I'd really like to have more anger in my life. That wasn't a choice like that. Nor does it mean your emotions, you know, made that decision. You somehow decided that, you know, you could be happy at any given time. It's something deeper, deeper than these surface levels of mind. That's where the habits have been entrenched. That's where they're running from. And we start through mindfulness. I think Andrea has said that what mindfulness does is it gradually lowers the baseline for consciousness. And what that means is we can see deeper and deeper into how the mind is operating. And so it starts to reveal some of these deeper patterns that are not, that we're not aware of at the surface. They're just running underneath, running the show. But slowly through awareness, we can start to see them more clearly. So the next question then is reflection. Have you ever wondered what you might be missing? What's being censored by your own mind before you even have a chance to have that sense experience? What filters are influencing it? If you went to the mailbox and you got out a letter and you opened it and there were, you know, like you see in the movies where an X-Acto knife has cut out certain words in or sentences in a letter where they've been blacked out or something, you would be very irritated by that, that your letter had certain things cut out of it and you weren't able to read the whole thing. But that's basically how our experience is all the time. There's some filters on there from our precognitive mind, if you will. So it's helpful to ask from time to time in practice, what else can be known? What else is here? So this is, it was very hard to see, you know, if the letter literally has an X-Acto knife, has cut out some words that are there, it doesn't matter how hard you stare at the letter, you're not going to be able to see them. But luckily, it's not quite as literal as a physical letter. We can invite the mind to start seeing more by asking things like, what else can be known? What else is here? We kind of invite the mind to take in a wider range of experience. We can't really know what we don't know, actually. That's why we don't know it. There's I heard a teacher describe it as an obsidian wall. Obsidian means very dark black, just like an obsidian wall in the mind. And you know, we don't even know what's beyond that. Something is occluded. But we can allow, through practice, this gradual process of opening up awareness. If we relate to our experience with what Utejaniya calls right attitude and right view and right effort, the three R's, he sometimes calls them, then we are initiating a process where we will slowly be able to see more of what's going on. We'll be able to take in a wider range of sense experience and hopefully more and more aligned with what is wise and useful at that moment. So we're getting more deeply into what we're doing through Dharma practice. We're slowly reshaping the mind-body system so that it is in sort of more often in a wholesome place, more often taking in the information that it really needs to make a wise decision. We're training it to see more clearly, to have less filtering. It's nice to have better filters, like wholesome filters that help the mind act in peaceful ways. But in the end, we would like to have at least some moments with no filters and, you know, really see things as they are. And we're training also to see what we do see, whatever range that is, in terms of wisdom. So you can see there's a lot going on. There's several different levels, and you don't have to worry about getting them all done consciously, because a lot of this happens just through wisdom doing its work. So I said, you know, we're slowly reshaping the mind-body system. That's an invitation. I have to be careful with language like that because it's an invitation for the kind of ego mind to come in and say, oh, good, what can I do? But it's not really me that's doing the reshaping, because it wasn't really me that put all those filters in place. That's all been going on through karmic habit over time. So I want to offer maybe some different language. I'll go back to some language I said earlier, which is that I see the Buddhist teachings as an invitation, you know, an invitation to slowly help the mind start connecting better with itself, such that it can, wisdom can start to do this work of interacting with the sense doors. So in Dharma practice, there is this invitation, opportunity really, to allow the teachings, which is what you hear from teachers, what you hear in quotes from the Buddha, what you read, etc., to really deeply interact with our mind and body and heart. And the teachings are pointing to something. They only point, as the saying says, they only point. But by that pointing, they can take the mind where it might not have gone on its own. So then listening to the teachings and, you know, just interacting with them, they start to draw out and sharpen various qualities of mind that are kind of poised to blossom. You know, it is true that the teachings have a kind of a catalyzing effect where something that's there, kind of, but maybe it needs a little help, like it needs like to be watered in order to bloom. Or it's like, I don't know, sometimes I use the analogy of an enzyme, for those of you who know about biology or chemistry, where there's a reaction that can happen. There's all the components for it, but there isn't quite enough energy for the two things to combine. So what the enzyme does is it provides an activation energy for a chemical process to take place that might not have otherwise. I think the teachings are like that. They help that to happen with things that are in our mind anyway. But we have to have some trust to allow the Dharma to reshape our mind in that way. One time on a 3-month retreat, I chanted a certain sutta every day, twice a day actually in Pali. And it took about a month of doing that, but after about a month, I started to have some insights into the meaning and the structure of the sutta. It wasn't even a very long one, but it took a little time for it to kind of soak into my mind and body. And the insights felt both individual for me, but also a universal, non-personal. And that was a long time ago. And now that I look back over quite a few years, I can see that the teachings in that sutta were actually speaking to something in my practice that was just kind of coming into fruition or coming into maturity on that retreat. I hadn't actually intended to do that chanting, but when I arrived at the retreat, I was drawn to it. I thought, oh, I should do this. Kind of, and felt that kind of inspiring that I wanted to do that. So I did, but it wasn't a plan. You know, it wasn't a plan. And so I have found that when those kinds of intuitions come and they have a feeling to them, like there's some wisdom there, if I trust that, there's always some good result from it. So let the Dharma decide what it is that you need to do in your practice next, and it'll probably be okay. So when the mind is well-trained in wholesome states, that means it's developed some of these wholesome habits and it's clearly seeing with some wisdom and with some continuity of mindfulness, it is possible for there to be a distinct shift in our experience. It's possible. I use the analogy sometimes of those wrenches that are ratchet. And so you turn them, and for a while you're just turning it, but if you turn it far enough, you click past one of the ratchets and it goes click and you can't turn it back. And that's the point of the wrench. So it can be like that in the mind. It's like we shape it for a while and then, you know, something can click into place. And we know that the mind's not going to go back to certain unwholesome states. Transformation is possible. As just one example, that was what the Buddha did when he awakened. He had no fear, he had no anxiety, he had no anger in his mind. Through his practice, he had clicked far enough that he completely eliminated the conditions for fear or anxiety or anger to ever come up. Those roots were cut, as they say in the teachings, but I'm using the ratchet analogy instead. Or going back to this analogy of the ruts, he had flattened out. He completely filled in the trench, let's say, so that the ruts were flattened out and his mind could never run along that track again. The track wasn't there anymore. So there is a lot to do in reshaping the mind, but more and more we can just turn that activity over to wisdom or the Dharma. And our job remains simpler, just to bring the awareness, to bring the right attitude. I'll read the verses again. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows, like a never-departing shadow. So the sutta, these verses very compactly tie the past to the present toward the future. Now, there's a way that experience flows and changes, and it's already flowing. It's not like we're starting anything up. So we're just reshaping and redirecting. We can incline the mind toward what is wholesome, mostly through just being aware. Then the mindfulness helps us very clearly see which directions are toward more or less suffering. But it is okay to aim a little bit. We can aim to act out of peace and not out of greed, aversion, and delusion. I often find in my mind, I can see both of those present. I can see maybe a little bit of ego there, but I also see generosity. And so I just incline toward acting more out of the generosity than out of the identification that might be present. And then we slowly shift our mind toward happiness that is coming from within, happiness that's coming from being present, from being with things as they are. It's not dependent on the world being a certain way. And we start to realize that it doesn't make sense to point out there toward where our problems are. It's all, here. And that's a very good thing. It's good news that it's all in your mind. So thank you. And I would invite any reflections or questions that you might have at this point. On this topic or on any other part of your practice, yeah, Bess.
Hi, thank you so much.
Hi, yeah.
Hey. The event is that I have a friend who complains about her family. And my reaction is irritation, because I think her family is doing fine by her. And so I'm trying to accept her as she is, except this is who she is, this is how she reacts, it's not my problem, it's hers. And then I also have aversion to the aversion, because I'm disappointed in myself for being irritated at her. So
why are you disappointed in yourself for that?
Because I'm being irritated, and I should be able to just accept her as she is, instead of making her problem my problem.
Yeah, so you have an ideal that you, as a perfectly spiritual person, you should always be patient and open.
Exactly.
So I'm just pointing out your view that's at play there. But maybe we could also see some connection where She's clearly in an aversive mind state at that moment, right? When she's complaining. And you can see that. And then you notice that you also have an aversive mind state come up. It's true that aversion creates more aversion. So it might be that you're a little bit getting infected by her aversion, in a sense. This can be a good realization for Dharma practitioners to have, because we realize that our inner mind states actually bleed out. You know, it's not that we're just all contained in ourselves. So I'm not surprised that some they talk about these mirror neurons, right? So you feel some aversion also. But if you're mindful of it, as it sounds like you are, you don't need to let it take over your mind. You're just experiencing that. I think your inclination sounds good, is that you have the intention that to just accept that this is her mind state right now, and it's her issue and not yours. How does she respond? Are you able to just stay with that and kind of not react? How does the conversation unfold?
I usually change the subject because she's not open to hearing my view of that her family is fine. So I usually just change this. I let her rant for a while and then change the subject.
Okay, that can be skillful. Yeah, the important thing is not to feed her mind state. And just to notice the impact that aversion has on other people, that helps you understand also when your mind is aversive, how you might be affecting other people, sort of by inference. So yeah, we're learning about how aversion works. And also the impact of having views and opinions and ideas about how things should be. See a little bit of dukkha being created in your own mind because of that. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's good practice. It's really so much of this world relies on what I like to call the bonding through mutual outrage. And it's just a phrase I've made up, but you know, it's a common pattern where somebody will say, "Can you believe how terrible this is?" And then the other person says, "I know, it's terrible." And you know, and there you go, you bonded through mutual outrage. But it's a really unwholesome pattern. And it's hard to find ways out of it when one person is trying to do that, trying to hook you into that. So it's important to keep the mind aware of that and not fall into that pattern. So good job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Other thoughts? Have you noticed how your mind conditions what you see? Like if you're in an irritated mood, you just see all the bad things, the torn carpet and all of that.
Oh,
yeah. Sveta.
Yes. Oh, thank you, Kim. Thank you so much for this teaching. It's exactly what I need to hear, I guess, right now. And you know, this idea that we are the architects, fully the architects of our experience. This, on the one hand, like when I first heard about this a couple of years ago, maybe, and like it was a little bit, maybe the first reaction, it was a little bit scary, like there's a lot of responsibility. But right. Then, you know, what over time, like I feel it's less scary, but more like actually a relief, gives a lot of agency. You know, things can be horrible sometimes, feel horrible, but, you know, it's all in me. And, you know, I don't rely on anybody to, you know, it's me, I'm doing this. So yeah, so I think it's a very happy teaching for me. Like, it gives me relief. And
that's great to hear. Yeah.
And I wanted to, if I may, I wanted to share a little bit about just my sitting today.
Sure.
It's, you know, I noticed that I had a shift recently in my practice. I would describe it as I'm like just more accepting of what is happening to me. I have, like, you know, when I become aware I'm here, it's less jerky, like it's softer. I worked a lot on this, like just kind of not be too demanding, not, you know, be too harsh on myself that I was lost. So I was really just kind of focusing on this transition moment when,
mm-hmm. yeah, and when awareness returns.
Yeah. So it's been my major practice for a while, because I do have a lot of rumination. And so it kind of over time, I decided this is what feels good for me, to just kind of focus on this moment and, yeah, be more compassionate and not judgmental.
Yeah.
And so I noticed that that things are kind of, that I kind of realized today, one of my insights today is that, wow, it's actually okay to be me like I am right now. And I realize how I have this tendency to be somebody else or like to change myself. And it's in my practice too, like, oh, things need to happen. Things need to happen. And so one of the things that is clear, like, I don't know when exactly it's become clear, is that it's also okay that things are as they are right now, that I'm doing what I'm doing. And this feels interesting.
Wow, what a revelation that things could be okay as they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's conditioned how things are. We got to this moment because of the causes and conditions, and it really couldn't be a different moment than it is. So that's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it is compassionate to accept things as they are. And that doesn't mean that we're accepting the overall state of the world as just fine, and we're, you know, accepting if other people are abusing us or something like that. It's not, and I know you're not saying that, but it's, I feel it's important to include that also, that we start from accepting, yes, this moment is conditioned, it is just as it is, and then that allows us to choose some way to go forward. But it's very important, yeah, to be as you are and not to be someone else. How could you be anyone else than who you are and what you are now? And it's fine. It's fine. So beautiful. Thank you for sharing. Anything else on your mind? It's also fine for us to wind up in a moment or so. Good. Well, what I wish for all of us is that we can continue to notice in the mind the way the current mind state was conditioned by the past, and then which aspects of it we choose to act from have an impact on how things go forward in the future. And it's, you know, it's a slow process of changing the mind, and things can shift at any moment, but with just the continual process of seeing how things are and aiming ourselves wisely to the next moment has a big impact over time, and it really can change things. So I love that we're all doing that. I feel inspired by all of your practice, and have a wonderful rest of the day. So be well, everyone. Feel free to unmute. Say goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you so much. Bye. Bye.